The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We've been dealing with a structure, systematic conceptualization of the process of the universe as so guided along by God. And we're simply plugging in basic Jewish ideas, and we see that they begin to make sense. A mitzvah, a commandment, halakha, various laws, are acts that coordinate our lives with the direction of life. And in the coordination, the synchronization, we become compatible with the movement, we become properly defined within the context of the theme of life. The principles of organization is the Torah. The Torah that we have from Moses is an articulation of the Torah, capital T-O-R-A-H, which are the principles which have governed the movement of history. And today I want to, within that context, clarify an important aspect of Torah. Because these principles that are governing the movement of life are modulating and directing the becoming to guarantee the fruition of the plan, the goal, the will. And therefore, in simple language, when I read the Torah, am I to assume that everything written in the Torah expresses the ideals of the Jewish people? Or perhaps there are things in the Torah that are expressing the way to the ideals, even though it might not itself be an expression of the ideals. The Torah is a system of values which is arranged in a certain hierarchy, where certain values are subordinate to others, and they're arranged in terms of leading us to the future. Certain values, which are authentically Jewish, might be temporarily conceded. There might be a temporary concession, and that concession is for the good of the future, even though what has been conceded is still of great value. It's just for now not. And who can organize such a thing? Who can decide which values might be subordinate and which values might overrule other values for the purpose of getting us to where we've got to go? Only God. Only God who can see, so to speak, the beginning, the end, the middle, can determine how this set of values and their priorities, as well as which values might need to be conceded for the sake of the fulfillment of others as well as the sake of the fulfillment of itself. So you can't always pick up the Torah and expect to see in there the ideals of Judaism. Because Torah is directing a becoming, a moral, ethical evolution of the human being. So let's give an example of such a thing to make it clear. There's a story about Rebbe, and he was walking down the street, and a little calf ran down the street and hid underneath his cloak, Rebbe's cloak. This little calf ran away from a slaughterer, and Rebbe turned to this calf and said, "Go back to be slaughtered, for this you have been created. Well, at that point, there was a divine decree against him in heaven, and he suffered great pain in his life until he fixed it by another incident. And what did Rebbe do wrong? I mean, we see that Jews do slaughter animals. So what did Rebbe do wrong? What Rebbe did wrong is he said, for this you were created. And that's not true. Animals were not created for human consumption. They were not created for man to be slaughtered. No. Original man and woman in the garden are eating fruits and vegetables. They are not eating animals. It was only later that God conceded to man, allowing man to eat meat. And when was that later? After the flood, man was allowed to eat meat. Okay? So this is very interesting. So then why did God allow us to eat meat? Well, it seems therefore that the eating of meat is not an ideal, because in the Garden of Eden, which expressed an ideal state of mankind, we weren't going to eat meat. But once we had fallen, thrown out of the garden, and the flood, all that, now God says, eat meat. Why? Well, it's hard to exactly know why. But what we do know is this is a concession. One of the whys that is suggested is that there is to a human being a basic inclination for cruelty. It wasn't the way they were created. But they, over time, incorporated within themselves a inclination of cruelty. And the question is, how does one sublimate that urge of cruelty? How do you sublimate it? And one is through the consumption of meat. There is something cannibalistic about, not cabalistic, you know, in terms of eating meat, it is a way of expressing aggression without very often people even being aware of that. But sometimes you have a craving. People have a craving for ice cream, people have a craving. You sometimes crave meat. And one aspect of that is that there is a side that needs and seeks to be expressed and satisfied. And better it be satisfied here than in some other area. Better that you didn't have it in the first place, right? But once you have it, it is to be satisfied. And that's a concession. But it's almost like, how do you change a person? How do you help a person grow? So let's say you have a person, chas v'shalom, you have a person who's a drug addict. Well, there's two approaches. One approach is, you know, cold turkey, they, you know, just stay off the stuff and you go through it. The other approach is, I walk into a hospital, I see these nurses handing out to the patients, you know, various measures of cocaine. I say, my gosh, what's going on over here? This must be a hospital that sanctions, right, drug abuse. No, you got it all wrong. These people are such abusers, such addictive people, that to get them off, we administer slowly less and less measures of cocaine till they're off the stuff. But anybody walking in there would, from their point of view, say, oh, it must be that the ideal of this place is cocaine. Well, that is one of the ways that is the Torah is understood. That there are halachot that do not express the ideals of Judaism, but are the way to reach those ideals. And so when we talk about consumption of meat, whatever the reason being, whether it is this craving, this cruelty, this need to sublimate that energy, Torah concedes, allows us to eat meat. But not only allows us, but really you should eat some meat. Okay? You should eat some meat. Even Rav Kook would have a little tiny piece of meat on Shabbat. Because you never know. You know? You never know. Maybe here you are being so nice to animals and you're such a vegetarian and you're really mean to people. You know? You never know. I don't know, this will get people upset. Well, I don't care anyways. But they say that Hitler was a vegetarian. And anyway, it was kind of funny. I wonder why. Maybe it was just a diet thing. But, you know, you always have to be careful. That sometimes you're adhering to a certain value, and as you're adhering to this value, in your conviction to that value, you are overstepping other values, which might be more important. Right? Do you follow? In other words, that's what's called a fanatic. There's nothing wrong with being devoted, committed, concerned. There's nothing wrong with if a person wants to lead a Jewish life, they lead it all the way. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not a fanatic. That's a person who is intense and committed. A fanatic is a person who, through their commitment to some values, are completely negligent of other values. In their desire so much to reach out to Jews, right, they steal money, let's say, to support their program, right? That would be a fanatic, right? I'm not saying that's a case that exists. I'm just giving an example of how that could happen, okay? Or in the process of having people over for Shabbos, you being so kind, invited 50 people for Shabbos and tell your wife, sweetheart, guess who's coming for dinner? That's a fanatic, right? Because in your apparent great devotion to, you know, chesed, you have not been chesed to your family, to your wife, right? You're ridiculous, right? So that's fanaticism. In Torah, sometimes certain values might be temporarily played down because other values are more important right now. And that's for the sake of even the value that right now is being conceded. But right now, people are cruel to people. And therefore, although people shouldn't be cruel to animals or people, but right now, unfortunately, this is our reality. And if we need it, we need it. And therefore, you will find in religious communities an encouragement towards eating meat, but nobody could ever halakhically force you to eat meat. If you don't want to, you don't want to. But you should think of that. That's all. Might be a one sliver on Shabbos, who knows. However, even though the halacha does not always indicate the ideals of Judaism, being that Torah is a modulating principle that is bringing us towards the fulfillment of the ideals of the universe, there are what's called windows to the future incorporated within halacha. In other words, well, okay, I will allow you to eat meat, but slowly in the evolution of man, I will start to pull the restrictions tighter and tighter. So the Jews, as the world evolves, will be told, well, now you can't eat all meat. And that's part of self-discipline and holding back and recognizing that even though I'm allowed to eat meat, I shouldn't feel completely comfortable to eat whatever meat I want. And not only that, there are certain animals that you can eat. The animals that you're allowed to eat are animals whose character is more domestic rather than wild animals like lions, tigers, and bear meat. Because we do believe you are what you eat in many ways. And so we are careful in terms of the kind of meat because we believe that the character of the animal is still in some way within the food. And so you want to be careful of its consumption. That's number one. So there's certain animals we don't let you eat. We also discourage you from eating meat too much, which is Jewish. In fact, the Ari says you shouldn't really eat meat during the week. You should just do it on Shabbos. Because an overconsumption of meat could bring you down rather than sublimate. It's like they say about sports. At one time they thought sports was a great way to allow men to release their aggression. Now they're finding that violence and sexual abuse is very high amongst sportsmen. Right? Very high. Well, you know, anything out of balance could have the opposite reaction. You know, sports is tough, you know, you're kicking this ball, you're always kicking a ball, hitting a ball, slapping a ball, and it really is, get it out, right? Get it out. But if you're too much into that, it becomes an ideal rather than way of getting it out, you start getting it in. So too, in Judaism, there is a discouragement towards overconsumption of meat, also. As well as now that we've allowed you to eat this meat, well, we don't allow you to eat meat with blood in it. Okay? We want you to eat meat with as little blood within the meat as possible. Because that's a little too much. To be eating meat with its blood pouring out of it is just too much. Okay? You shouldn't feel so comfortable eating the meat. You should at least prepare it in such a way to minimize the amount of blood that's in the meat, as well as we believe that the soul is connected to the blood and you don't want more animal soul in your body. So we prepare this meat. Right? We prepare this meat. One way of preparing it is through salting it. And the salt draws blood out of the meat. Okay? So the meat should be salted. It should be freshly salted. There are opinions that if the meat was slaughtered properly and frozen and then thawed out after 3 days and then salted, it's problematic. And that's what's called basar kafu, frozen meat. And so you can go into restaurants here and they have meat, but it's not, but it's frozen meat from Argentina that was salted here. But still, halakhically, there is the possibility to eat that too. Because the question is, once it's been frozen, now does the salting have as much effect on the blood once the blood was frozen and then... Okay. So you salt this meat. Not only do you salt this meat, another way of drawing the blood out of it is roasting. Not roasting. Over an open fire. That's it, roasting. Okay? While it's over this open fire, the fire draws it out. And that's one of the problems with liver. Liver salting's not good enough to get the blood out of it. You can't get the blood out of it with salting it. So what you do is you salt it, and then you broil it or you roast it on a grill where the blood can draw out of it and fall into a pan underneath it. Certainly not into a pan in it, because then it's just going right back in. But the concern again is to draw this blood out, as well as the way it was slaughtered in the first place. The way the animal is slaughtered is in a way which maximizes the most immediate outpour of the most blood. Okay? To get this blood out of this animal, so that at least when we eat this animal, there is much less blood, and then we even salted it, so we really, you see that the Jews do not want to eat blood. That is just too barbaric already. And at this point, we should already be sensitive to that, and we should be moving towards that. As well as the way it's slaughtered, not only in terms of the particular place of the cut, which maximizes that outpour of the blood, But the knife itself has to be checked every single time by the slaughterer to make sure that there isn't a nick. Okay? Now there was places, and there still is today, places that have tried to make Jewish ritual slaughter illegal, claiming that it's inhumane. Right? It's inhumane, we've tested it, there's a better way of slaughtering animals, it's through electrical shock. Okay? Through electrical shock. And I think there is a place even today, I don't remember where, I think in England there was a place, that they successfully passed this and made kosher meat illegal. Imagine that. Illegal because it's inhumane to animals to slaughter them with a knife. Now they've shown, they put nodes on animals, and they showed that the animal has a much more traumatic reaction in its death, right, by being slaughtered by the knife rather than slaughtered by a shock. Now, you know, it's kind of hard to know, you know, how much the animal is going through pain when you're already killing him anyways. But even more than that, what is the meaning of humane in the first place? Isn't humane all about maintaining my humaneness, right? My humanness. I mean, what is less humane? Having a conveyor belt of hundreds of animals as they're just going along and some guy behind some glass booth going, bzz, 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 bzz. Well, that's really humane. Right? Or someone who's really very conscious of what they're doing and very careful of what they're doing. Right? And very aware that this is, we're slaughtering animals. So maybe the animal is under greater pain, although we still don't believe that to be true. But even if we could prove such a thing, there's another value here that is more important. And that value is to maintain an awareness that we are slaughtering animals and we can't feel comfortable about it. We've got to be able to see this blood come out. We've got to get it all over our clothing kind of thing and not feel so comfortable about it that we can be so sophisticated as we sit beside some behind some booth and go, bzz, 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 bzz. Sorry. No, that's more inhumane because you lose your sensitivity to what you're doing. As well as when the blood pours out of the animal, you have a mitzvah to cover the blood. Why do I have to cover the blood? Because I'm not so comfortable. I shouldn't feel so great about what's going on here. They said, a Hasidic story, there was a new slaughterer in the shtetl. And whenever he would slaughter, of course, he would always sharpen his knife between each slaughtering, and so he would spit on the sharpening rock and sharpen the knife. Also, said, you're very different of a ritual slaughterer than the fellow before. He said, well, what was the difference? He says, the way you wet your sharpening rock. So, yeah, what was the difference? He said, he used to wet it with his tears. So, you know, there is a Jewish consciousness that is really very concerned and very sensitive about what's going on. And so there's windows to the future. The laws of kashrut is to maintain a certain humanness. You don't eat any old animal, and you certainly don't eat animals which are of a wild nature. You don't eat animals with their blood in it, because that is already barbaric. You shouldn't feel so comfortable consuming their meat. And you should be concerned about purchasing meat that you know has been slaughtered in the most humane way, which isn't necessarily the most pain-free way, although we still think it is, but the most painful way for a human being to do it. Right? So that there's still that consciousness that this is not the ideal, this is not what we want to ultimately be doing. So that's one example of how a person could look at Jewish law and say, oh, well, you see, you know, it's okay. Right? Rav Kook suggests that one of the reasons why you're not allowed to eat milk and meat together is because you really have no right to take something like dead meat and something like milk, which is a symbol of life and nurturing, and put those things together. That's too much. You've got your values wrong. Now, a person can say, oh, I don't really think about it with my cheeseburger. Well, who cares if you don't think about it? You should think about it. As well as it has a certain subliminal effect when you're concerned about the way you eat. It is interesting, as I've mentioned before, there's so many laws regarding food in Judaism. But because food has a very strong impact on the way we perceive ourselves and how it influences the way we feel about ourselves. In addition, for instance, what about sacrifices? Well, certainly Rav Kook's approach, and sacrifices don't really express the ideal of Judaism. It's a concession from God. God allows us sacrifices because we need sacrifices to express what we're trying to express. God certainly doesn't want it because, as it says, Rachamav kol ma'asav, God's compassion is on all His creatures. But in light of the situation, the place where the human being is, man, conceded to man is, allowed to man is, sacrifice. Now, a lot of people have a lot of problems with sacrifice. But I don't see why they should have any more problems with sacrifice than they have with Ronnie McDonald. Because, you know, at least there it's some kind of way to uplift myself spiritually. It's not just consuming meat because I like the taste of it, right? But let's say you're a vegetarian and still very disturbed about animals. Well, the Rambam, they're not all agreed with his approach, but the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim explains that sacrifice was a concession of God to the Jews. The Jews needed a form of expressing their connectedness to God, one which was similar to the culture of their times. That was the religious mode of expression. And therefore God allowed for that to be. However, there is a Gemara that says in the future the sacrifices will be nullified. There won't be sacrifice. And Rav Kook certainly takes that approach, that they will be nullified. And Rav Kook delineates, from a Jewish point of view, an evolutionary process. That when the temple be reinstated, there will be a movement towards only slaughtering animals for holy purposes, and not for plain human consumption. And then after that, there will be a new stage in the temple where it will no longer even be allowed to slaughter animals, and they will only bring flour sacrifices. For flowers. And then, for all you flower lovers, it will evolve to a house of prayer. However, the sacrifices is understood to be some kind of concession. Whether it's a concession to the cultural, or a concession to where man is at and what he needs. Now, here comes the question. Well, I feel really uncomfortable with sacrifices, so why should I pray for the temple? You know, I can't honestly say I really look forward to all those sacrifices. What if you're a person that says a thing like that? We're a much higher level now. We don't need that anymore. Well, certainly traditional Judaism believes we do need that. Right now, obviously, God doesn't allow us to have a temple because He sees that sacrifices would be meaningless. Right? As God says, it's not your sacrifice I want, it's your tshuva. And the sacrifice is a detail in a tshuva process. And if it's not, then you simply killed an animal. So if we don't have a temple, part of that reason is because we obviously are not ready for a temple. But we still believe that eventually we will need a temple. And it's clear, even to the Rambam, that that temple will have sacrifices. Well, as long as people are still slaughtering animals for, you know, food consumption, then it's clear that the temple will have sacrifices as we slowly draw out of any animal consumption. Okay? So it's a process. It's understood to be a process. and certain things and certain halachot are not always indicative of an ideal. Right? It's where people are at. There is a very disturbing piece in the Torah called A Captured Woman. It talks about men at war, and what if during this war, one of these men see this woman, right? This POW, this prisoner of war, whatever, and he is just inclined towards her. Now, you know, in times of war, unfortunately, but that's the fact, people in that situation are under a difficult strain, right? They don't act the same way they act when they're out of war, okay? And what have happened to women in the past during war and what warriors did, and when you even hear about the stories about what Saddam Hussein's soldiers did to women in Kuwait, it's just very heavy, right? So, the Torah prescribes a certain behavior. If you see this woman, and you have this desire for her, well, so you can take her home, but you can't touch her for like a month. You can't change her clothing. You can't, so you have these certain restrictions. And so the Talmud on this place says, God says, I created an evil inclination and I created an antidote. It's called Torah. Torah is an antidote to an evil inclination. And therefore, the Torah is not giving sanction to, go ahead, enjoy, why not, right? Everything's free. It's precisely offering a realistic approach to how to stop people from doing that. But it's not realistic to just say, don't do that, right? But if you say, well, you can do it, but you don't touch her for a month, and then after a month, he gets a chance to really think about, well, is this really who I want, and is this just infatuation, or am I really very interested in marrying this woman, and da-da-da, is she going to convert? So the Torah has laws in it that do not necessarily express the ideal, but bring us to the ideal. The fact that we feel uncomfortable with these kinds of halachot, halacha would say, was halacha's success. That man has evolved. That people are more sensitive. Because Torah has been working towards that. So let's say you find in the Torah stories about, you know, slaves. Buying and purchasing slaves. Well, as a person in the 20th century, you know, one of these universalistic liberal Jews, I said, oh, come on, how am I supposed to read this stuff? How am I supposed to relate to this stuff? Well, in light of the times, if you were a slave, you'd be so happy that a Jew bought you. Because, as it says in the Torah, there are various responsibilities that the Jew has to the slave. If you have one pillow, you have to give it to him. Right? He has to be living with the same kind of standard as you. You're not allowed to leave, give him work and say, you do this until I come back. You have to tell him exactly when you're coming back because then you're mentally abusing him because he doesn't know when are you coming back. As the Talmud says, anybody who buys a slave bought a master. So when you put it in that context, yes, people were selling and buying slaves. But the Torah's attitude towards slaves, in many ways, was discouraging people to get the slave. And if you got a slave, boy, that slave was really happy. Okay? He was really happy. And nowadays you see nobody has slaves. And Jews don't go buying slaves. And if you ask your rabbi, Rabbi, I'd like to go buy myself a slave. He says, oh, come on, what kind of Jew goes buying slaves? So everybody says here in the Torah. No. So it says in the Torah, it doesn't know mitzvah to buy a slave, it's if you're buying slaves, this is what goes on. Okay? It doesn't say you have to buy slaves. So now you have a situation. On one hand, people would feel, you know, a certain natural discomfort towards the notion of slavery. But maybe that would be a solution for the homeless. And maybe in that situation, slaves would be a good idea. I believe it was Rav Kook who also said, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, workers were being so sorely abused. You know, in the coal mines, the conditions, how many of these people died and they were being paid peanuts and they were treated like dirt. But what happened if you would have instituted the slave laws? Right? Instead of people being hired for pennies, you just buy them and you take care of them. Boy, would you take care of them. Because this is your property. This is your slave. You don't want to lose your slave, you just purchased this slave. So you see, in that situation, slavery would be the most ethical, much more ethical than what's going on. Of course, the ideal is neither slavery nor this. But in light of the situation, sometimes a certain value is conceded because it will bring us slowly to the higher value, including the one that was just conceded. Okay? And so too, many things that you find difficult in the Torah, that very often, it's not an indication of the ideals. Okay? So let me bring up a sticky issue. The issue of women getting divorces in Jewish tradition. Well, so the man gives a divorce to his wife. A woman doesn't give a divorce to a man. Why? Well, as it was explained to me, a divorce is a very big schlep. It takes a lot of work. You got to go hire the scribe and get the this and do the that. There's a lot that goes into it. It is an involved technical process. So Torah put that responsibility on the man. Not to diminish the rights of the woman, because in those days, if a woman wanted a divorce from her husband, he had a Sanhedrin, you had some people with more consciousness, he would give it to her, right? They would go to the Sanhedrin, she would present her case, right? He would present his case. And if a woman wanted a divorce, she would get a divorce. And he would be the one that had to run around and get the get, right? He's burdened with it. The understanding was that it wasn't to burden the woman with these technical things. This is what he should be doing. But now in our situation, we find a very sad situation. In those days, there was really a problem, you know, in terms of technically, practically, you know, a woman wanting a divorce and he doesn't want to give a divorce and she doesn't want to be married to him. Practically, she wouldn't be married to him anymore. No one would force her. Right? But nowadays, unfortunately, what?
In the past?
Right. If you were in a Torah community, right? Living under the context of Torah consciousness, so then the notion of a get would not be a problem. You have to understand that the problem with the notion of a get is not a Torah problem. It's a problem because within the present society, right, it's become a problem. Because in those days, if she wanted a divorce, he would give her a divorce. But he's responsible to do the running and the giving and the da, and all that. That's all. But it wasn't to in any way diminish her rights. In fact, it was to give her more rights that she wouldn't have to have the burden of getting and paying and doing what it takes to get the divorce. He would. But now what has turned out to be? There are situations now where a woman wants a divorce and he doesn't want to give her a divorce. And so we don't have a Sanhedrin. And so now we have a problem. This woman can't get divorced. You can be sure the original will of God is that should not happen. And in those days when we had a Sanhedrin, and if a rare case were to arise that a man did not want to give a get to his wife, although she wanted it, it was no problem. They would beat him until he said, I'll give it to her. And he did. Right? And that was the way they ran it. And so it's really a rarity and not a problem. But today it's a problem. Because there are these men who are holding out for a large amount of money, women on the line, not being divorced. And of course, it's obviously not fair from a Torah point of view. You can be sure God doesn't want this. So what do you do? Right, so what do you do? Well, so one of the things you do is you reinstitute the way they used to do it. Which is you beat this guy until he goes ahead and does it. Ah, so who goes and does that? Meir Kahana did. I mean, he actually set up a group that people could call, and they would do the facts and the this and the that. And this woman could call, and you knew that there's someone who's ready to say, it's not fair, and we will beat you up until you do it. Now in Israel, they send you to jail, but there's some guys who have such a venom. Yeah, you could go to jail. Right? If you withhold a get from your wife. Yes, everything goes through the religious. Everything. Marriage and gets, and death goes through religious.
How does that happen?
Because I think for some reason the Israelis understand that, you know, there's something to tradition. Okay? So it's still a problem. Ah. So now in Meir Shearim, a couple months ago, I was walking there and I saw a picture of a nice looking man all over the streets. And I wondered, I mean, it's very rare to see a picture of a nice looking man. Not that you can't find a nice looking man in Meir Shearim, but it's rare to have pictures of him all over the street. And so I, of course, went to see it. And what did it say on this? It said, this man has denied his wife a divorce, and therefore nobody should speak to him, no one should allow him in their stores, and they're heavy out to get him to do it. There is now a group of rabbis who are working on a halachic solution. Because you can't just say, well then, fine, so then forget about the whole thing and women should give gets. You can't do that. You have to create a halachic solution within the context of a halachic solution. So there is now presented a halachic solution, which is in the ketubah. They write a ketubah and they write a conditional marriage under the condition that the High Court of Israel accepts it. At the point that the High Court does not accept it, it will retroactively demonstrate that this was not a marriage, and it's completely annulled. And now it's a slow process, but there are many people working on it, and it's a halakhic solution. Right? And therefore, we don't need this man at this point, because he engaged her under condition, which is a halakhic idea, that you can engage someone, you can marry someone under a condition. Okay, so there's halakhic solutions, and it wouldn't be a problem. Okay, but again, when you see something in the Torah, you can't assume that it expresses the ideals. For instance, I see in the Torah that a woman can't be a judge. All right, a woman can't be a judge. We see that Devorah was a judge, so there are some opinions say that a woman can be a judge. Also, can a woman be a judge or not? So the Tosfos explains that one of the reasons why a woman can't be a judge is because in society, her judgment, unfortunately, would not be accepted as much as a man's. That's just a reality. Okay? If there is a society whereby they are ready to accept the decision of a woman as a judge, she certainly be a judge. But it had no indication whatsoever of her judging powers, right? It had an indication with the social evolution of where the community is at in terms of relating to women. Now one could say, well, doesn't it promote that? Not if you're a genuine Jew. Not if you're a person who really understood Torah and understood a moral encompassing understanding of God's compassion and God's love and all the various places. No. But when you take something out of context and you really don't know, and you've lost that old-fashioned religion feeling of what a community, a genuine Torah community, was all about. So of course it looks really very strange. Right? Of course it looks very strange. So the point they're making is there's many places in the Torah that one could look at it and their hair could stand on end because they say, is that what my religion aspires to? And very often, it's not what your religion aspires to. But your religion is one which is cultivating the human being to reach a level to what it aspires to. And sometimes certain values, which are really important, might be, for now, conceded for another value. Okay? For instance, so Rav Kook, in one of his articles, explains that some of the major breakdowns in the world was because someone was too hasty. What are you talking about? This is art. The body is beautiful. Why should we be hiding it? Well, you're right. Judaism believes the body is beautiful. Judaism accepts that ideally the first man and woman were frolicking around the garden without any clothing on. But that's not where you're at. Right? And that's all. So, there's a value here in terms of appreciating the beauty of the body. But there's another value here which is maintaining a sanctity and a sensitivity towards the physical, right? And not abusing it. And therefore, you're right. I'm sorry, although you are wonderful artists and, you know, maybe your intentions seem to be pure. But socially and culturally, and I don't even think where you're at, right, that's what we're able to be doing now. Okay? So there's things that, you know, one could theoretically understand to be a good thing, but that doesn't mean in actuality the world is ready to be doing that. Okay? And the Torah is modulating. The Torah is guiding. The Torah is developing man towards a place where these situations will no longer even arise. Right? They just won't arise anymore. Because of that evolution. That a human being in war won't even want to take this woman. Okay? Because we've been instilled and we've slowly been drawn out of this. So this is very, very important because without this, it's very hard sometimes to understand basic pieces in the Torah. I am not suggesting that the Torah, therefore, is time-bound. And like it was only referring, you know, the reason why we eat kosher or we can't eat pig is because in those days, you know, they didn't have refrigeration and da-da-da-da-da. No, I'm not saying that. I have the right to do anything against the Torah, right? In other words, there's, you know, no mitzvah that I must eat meat. So if I feel I don't want to eat meat, I don't have to, although I really should have a little bit. But in terms of pig, it says don't eat pig, and I have no right to rationalize, well, that was in those days. Right? In those days. It has nothing to do with those days, these days. This is how the Torah perceives it. This is how it's presented. Okay? And so it's not a time-bound rationality in terms of, you know, this is how it was in those days. No, that's not what I'm saying over here in terms of, well, in those days, that's what they were, so that's what they needed. We don't need this anymore. No. The idea is that the Torah is relating to man and has been designed in such a way that its halachot direct us, even where we're at right now. Okay? And there's nothing in there that I can say is no longer important and I don't have to keep. There's no source for that approach. Okay? I'm not saying there aren't people who are going to do that. Right? But certainly there's no source for that approach.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.